psalm, and the Bible is broken up into historical books and then prophetic books, major prophets and minor prophets. But then you have these books of poetry and wisdom. They start at the book of Job. They continue in order through the Song of Solomon. They don't give you much history in the sense of, you know, you're caught up in the moving forward of time rolling over by the tens and hundreds of years. But rather, they are written from the standpoint of present tense relationship with God. Most of these wisdom books or poetry books address what are usually the most difficult of questions. You know, why does God allow suffering? Why am I in this position? When is he going to answer my prayer? How long do I have to wait? They're the common issues of life that believers, I think, come to at some point in their life. And it seeks to bring that kind of answers from the Lord. So that's really where we're at. And until we get to the Song of Solomon and beyond, when we go into the prophetic books and then find ourselves looking back into the history or forward, we're caught in this present tense development of our walks with the Lord. We began last time the book two of the Psalms. And they are split up into books. Psalm 51 begins book two. From Psalm 51 to Psalm 72, where the second book of Psalms ends, all but four of the Psalms are written by David, the king. Many of them in this section have these very helpful introductions in the header, which makes listening to the prayers or to the worship or to the song or to the cry far easier or more meaningful because you know the circumstances upon which those things are written. So, you know, when you study the Psalms, you really want to try to find out what the Lord wants you to learn from listening in on the prayers of others upon their confidences in the Lord. And if you can get the history of the background even better, then you can put yourself in that position. You know, what would I be thinking if I was in that position looking at that situation? How would I act as a believer? But all of the Psalms tonight, from 56 through 60, are written by David, and all of them are introduced as michtams. The word michtam means to engrave or to cut in Hebrew. It is used to describe something that lasts. And in other words, I didn't just use erasable pencil or, you know, ink that fades, but this was engraved or permanent. I think it was Job, written about the time of Genesis, who cried out and said to the Lord, "I wish that my words were written and engraved or inscribed in a book and engraved upon a rock with an iron pen and lead that would last forever. And then I would write, I know that my Redeemer lives." So that's where that wording comes from. And so every one of these are written down in the sense of, you know, these are permanent lessons that you want to learn. And they're introduced that way in the introductory sentence before verse 1. All of the Psalms tonight bring David in some place of suffering back to the Lord, whether it's to trust him to get him out of trouble or to win a battle or to find direction as to what he's supposed to be doing or to get wisdom that he doesn't feel he has. And it does seem like these repeated lessons that you find in the book of Psalms of learning to pray, waiting for God to speak, keeping an eye out for his hand moving, you know, would teach us that walking with the Lord is not such an easy process. But when you find them repeated so often, it's almost like the Lord saying to us, you know, it's going to take some effort on your part, some work, some commitment, but it's worth the effort. And so you find David in these situations often, and I think it is worth, you know, grabbing a hold of some of these verses, especially in the context in which they're used, and, you know, being able to relate to your walk with the Lord and how sometimes we, like David, you know, are praying and God's not answering. Or we're looking for an open door and all we keep doing is bumping our nose against a closed one. And how come the Lord hasn't answered? And why is he doing what he's doing? And those are important questions. But if you're going to grow in your faith, you want to find, you know, peace with them and resolve them before the Lord. Psalm 56 was written, we are told in the introduction, at a time when David found himself in the Philistine city of Gath. He had been fleeing from King Saul. He was up to his neck now in deep water because he had showed up in this city, in a foreign country, in the birthplace and in the hometown of Goliath, carrying Goliath's sword. And not a brilliant move. He was immediately captured and thrown in prison and then had an appointment with the king to see, you know, were they going to kill him today or tomorrow? Psalm 34, which is the companion for this, was written after David's escape from Gath. How David got out, you know, right? David started spitting up on himself. He ran into the wall as if he was out of his mind. He rolled around on the ground and pretended to just be nuts. And the king went, no, we don't need to kill this guy. That would be merciless. Just throw him out of here. He's obviously a loony, you know? And they threw him out, and David escaped, and then he went to the Adullam caves back in the land of Israel, and then felt so guilty that he had, you know, relied on that kind of foolishness rather than relying upon the Lord. And so that's what Psalm 34 is about. This seems to have been written, at least in great part, maybe except for the ending couple of verses, before David met with the king and when he didn't yet know what was going to become of him, in the hopes that he would do something faithfully as he faced what seemed to be certain curtains for him. You know, put yourself in his shoes for a minute. He's under lock and key in a foreign country. The foreign country is a hereditary foe of Israel. Outside your cell, men are watching you who have lost family in the wars with Israel, and you are the prize POW. And now you're in their power. And so David finds himself looking for God's mercy and his might. You know, this is one of those situations of life that things are out of your control, except to say, David brought this on himself. This wasn't just, you know, I'm doing the right thing and I'm suffering. This was, I'm doing the wrong thing and I'm suffering now. I wish I hadn't done it. But it is a situation out of control. Like, I still think most of life is out of control. You know, you think you've got a handle on stuff until you figure out that you don't. You know, you don't know what's going to happen in the future. God is able, so that's where you rest. So David writes, Michtam of David, be merciful to me, God, for man would swallow me up, and fighting all day he oppresses me, my enemies hound me all day, there are many who fight against me, O Most High. And whenever I am afraid, I will trust in you, God, I will praise your word, in God I have put my trust, I will not fear, what can flesh do to me? Now, David had made a huge mistake coming here to begin with. The moment he crossed the borders of Israel and went into Philistine land, he stepped out of the will of God. And I would suggest to you, he pretty much stepped out of the sphere of God's blessing. God does, it seems, in the Bible, draw circles around us. You know, he draws circles around your kids by placing him in a home with godly parents and parental authority. And if as a kid you can learn to stay in there and grow, you'll do fine. The Lord puts a circle around a wife so that her husband might, in good spiritual leadership, take care of her, and around a husband. And as long as you stay in the circle, you're good. You know, God can work and move and speak. He does the same thing for you as you go to work or as you come to church or as you live in the society and the government and all. But whenever you leave those circles, you know, through unbelief, through disobedience, through self-will, you can also walk away from that experience of the blessings of God upon your hand. And so David, he's outside the circle, you know. He's gone where he doesn't belong. And he immediately asks for God's mercy, because he's in the wrong place. God, give me mercy. It's almost like you can hear the footsteps outside of David's cell. You know, guys looking in the window, threatening David, laughing at him. You know, we've got you now, buddy. Interestingly enough, when David speaks here about man in verse 1, he uses the word Enosh, which is, at least in Hebrew, the word for mortal man in his sin or in his weakness. It's a word that describes man, but he describes man in his weakness, at his weakness point, or because of sin that he's weak. But yet when he speaks about God in verse 1, he uses the word Elohim, which is the word that is used to speak of God who is the creator of all. If David was going to get through this, he was going to have to see the guys outside the cell as weak individuals, tainted by sin, facing a God who had made all things. And even in his prayer to the Lord, you know, he has to be able to look at his situation from God's standpoint. These guys are no match for the Lord. David hadn't followed the Lord here. This wasn't the place God wanted David to be, but he was here. And in his dilemma, he cries out, Lord, I want you to help me and be merciful to me, because you're the God of everything, and these guys are broken in sin. I know that they're no match. Man would swallow me up. And they fight against me, and they oppress me. and there are many who fight, he says in verse 2, O God Most High. And he doesn't use the name of the Lord Elyon, which is usually what the words Most High are a definition of, but he uses the word Ma'arom, which is a word that means one who is highly exalted. And it is almost as if David is saying, here these weaklings are standing up against the God who made everything. We'll see who gets exalted in the long run. We'll see who has the last word here. And David locks himself in on the truth of what he knows, though he has created a pretty bad situation for himself. Whenever I'm afraid, I'm going to trust you and praise your word and put my trust in you and not fear what man or flesh can do to me. I don't know if you've ever read some of David Livingstone's writings about his ministry in Africa. They were written in the 1850s or so, at least the journal that he kept. But, I mean, this is the Livingstone, you know, who was so convinced that the Lord wanted him to minister to the natives and to the tribal folks. And he really was breaking new ground. In fact, he died there. But he wrote at one of his entries in his journal, and it was early on in January of 1856. He wrote this before he went into this new territory. I felt much turmoil of spirit in the prospect of having all of my plans for the welfare of this great region and this teeming population knocked in the head by these savages. But I read tonight that Jesus said, Lo, I am with you always, even to the ends of the earth. And so I will not cross furtively tonight as I had intended to sneak by. Why should such a man as I flee? No, I will work in the day, even if tomorrow is my last day. Thank God I can go to bed. So, you know, here's another guy who has to put into action what he believes. And I'm not going to be afraid, and I'm going to trust what you say, and I'm going to put my confidence in you. And David, in this jail cell, was in the same position. Here's man in his weakness. Here's God in his greatness. Here's mortal man and Almighty God. No contest. But I got to know that. I might have been a fool coming here, but they're foolish in opposing him. And so David seeks to find peace in God's promises and has to willfully and mindfully and with all that he can muster, put himself trusting what God says. That's always a battle. Your head can be filled with the truth, but applying it's another deal, isn't it? To trust God to provide. I think that most people that work and have a job and have an income can say, oh, the Lord provides for my needs. But the guy who can say it when he's out of work, and he doesn't have a prospect of a job, and he's looked everywhere, and he's not getting ahead of himself. Now, there's the man who's come to know God as he should. So we have to be able to place into action that which we know. And David, verse 5 writes, all day they're twisting my words. Their thoughts are just against me for evil. They're gathering together, hiding, marking my steps when they lie in wait in my life. When they lie in wait for my life, sorry. Shall they escape by iniquity in anger? Cast down the people, God. I mean, David weighs his present circumstance against the divine certainty that he would not perish here. He believed that God was going to make him king. God said that he would. And the enemy had been putting on the pressure through threats and lies, innuendos. People are chasing around. This, by the way, was David's first run for his life when Saul had decided to go public with his I'm going to kill David idea. And so David would now run for the next 7.5 years. But David just says, Lord, you got to pay them back for their malice. And don't let their wicked ways succeed. It's a good prayer. Rather than doing anything about it, he's going to tell the Lord. You, he said in verse 8, number my wanderings and put my tears into your bottle. Are they not in your book when I cry to you? Then my enemies will turn back. This I know because God is for me. It's not easy, I think, to walk God's path, you know, not in the world, especially in God's school where the exams are all stiff, you know, and there's no grading on the curve. You just got to learn the lessons. Not much fun, you know, to have to learn to live by faith. And David often finds himself in the gospel, in the Psalms, in tears. But he really believed that God valued the hurts that led him along the ways of life. That's an important concept, I think. I heard someone say one time, there is no wasted suffering with God. In other words, God doesn't enjoy you being in tears or brokenhearted or fearful or struggling. That's not in God's economy of blessing. But if the result is that you're closer to him and you're more at rest and you're able to be delivered, then that's exactly what God wants to accomplish. I don't know if when you were, you know, your kids were little, you sent them to your room and you heard the screaming, you know, and I hate you and I'm not coming. And you're like, oh. But you just knew it was going to help them, you know? And the Lord will take you through that in many ways as well. God won't waste suffering. And even if we bring it on ourselves, God can use it for good. I don't know if you know who William Cowper was, but he was a fellow whose mother died. I think he was 6, and they put him in boarding school, and he was tortured by kids day and night. In fact, he wrote of his life years later, "Day and night, I was on the rack, lying in horror, rising in despair." And as a young man who was pretty much led by no one, they put him in an insane asylum where he tried to commit suicide. He stayed there for years. At 33 years old, he got saved, and he became one of the most prolific worship songwriters in the history of the church. And one of the things he said when asked about his journey through life, he said, "God was mindful of my tears." And God brought him through. So what the cankerworm seeks to destroy, as the prophet says, God can restore. And David knew that, and he believed that God would see him through this. "Put my tears in the bottle. Aren't they in the book when I cry out?" I know there's a purpose for this. David would learn not to run and hide in these kind of places, for one thing. "But I've trusted in God. I won't be afraid," verse 11, "what man can do to me." In fact, verse 10, he says, "For the second time," as he said in verse 4, "in God I will praise his word. In the Lord I will praise his word." Third time. "In God I've put my trust. I won't be afraid what man can do to me." Here's the refrain of the song. You know, here's the repeat, if you will. And I think we've mentioned it to you before, but whenever the Psalms, especially these poetic books, are repetitive, it isn't because someone is stuttering or lost their train of thought. Hebrew poetry makes exclamations by repetition. So if you read, you know, something over and over, it's meant to highlight, if you will, or put a exclamation point behind. "I will praise his word." He says it 2 times here, 1 time in verse 4. I'm going to praise God for his promises in his word. And that's why I know what I know. And so he says in verse 12, "Vows made to you are binding upon me, God. I will render praise to you. You've delivered my soul from death. Have you not kept my feet from falling, that I might walk before God in the light of the living?" So it seems that in this horrible situation, David had made God some promises. And usually promises are easy to make when you're in despair, but keeping them when you're delivered, that's another story. And David was mindful of that. And so maybe he had gotten out now and he had realized it was the Lord's work and said, "I'm going to do it your way, Lord, I promise. Even as I promised, I'm going to walk with you." In chapter 57, we have a psalm that again is a michtam of David, but this says he wrote this when he was fleeing from Saul into the cave. I mentioned to you, and I think if you've been around for a while, you know that Saul chased David 7.5 years. And then for the next 7.5 years, once Saul died, David became king of one tribe rather than the whole country. It was only the last 33 years of his rule that everyone agreed he would be the king that God had chosen. So David spent a long time in the minority, if you will. And a lot of it had to do in the running with learning to trust God, because David came out of this thing not only really close to the Lord, but he had hundreds of guys that were just misfits that he trained in these running affairs, if you will, trained them how to trust the Lord and walk with God. This one was written on an occasion of hiding in a cave. If this was the hiding in the cave where Saul pulled into the same cave because it was real hot out, 1 Samuel, I think it's chapter 24, then we know the story. In these 11 verses of chapter 57, David refers to God by name or by personal pronouns some 21 different times. That's a lot, in Hebrew especially. So he trusted him because he knew him. And this is David's kind of lesson that he wants to inscribe, and he wrote it on the occasion of running into Saul there in the cave. Verse 1, "Be merciful to me, God, be merciful to me." You see the repetition, it denotes extreme kind of crying. "For my soul trusts in you, and in the shadow of your wings I will make my refuge until these calamities have passed me by." There is an often used picture in the scriptures of the Lord being like a hen and we the little chicks. You don't find it just in the New Testament there where Jesus is on Palm Sunday praying over the city. But you find God describing that same kind of relationship in so many places. You know, he wants to be the protector and he wants us to run to him. He invites us to come. He spreads his arms out. He's available. And we can either come and hide in him or we can't. David was running from Saul, but he was running to the Lord more often than not. And that was a good lesson. He said in verse 2, I'm going to cry out to God Most High who performs all things for me. The word performs is an interesting Hebrew word because it means to bring to an end or to put a stop to. You'll only find it, I think, 5 times in the Old Testament, all of them in the book of Psalms, all of them to describe God's action in man's behalf. God put an end to this. 7.5 years, can you imagine? But I'm going to cry out to the God who's going to put an end to this for me. He'll send from heaven and save me. He'll reproach the one who would swallow me up. So David was learning in the wilderness to put God between himself and the trials that he was facing. I think that's a great practice. If somehow, whenever you're facing anything, if you can just put God between you and the problem, you'll do better than if you just kind of advise God about the problem. Well, here, I've been praying, and then they'll tell you what they told the Lord to do, and the Lord hadn't done it. Better you just get behind the Lord, you know? I'm great at making faces at the devil behind the Lord. I remember there was a bully when I was in third grade who used to whip the snot out of us, about 6 of us. We couldn't 6 of us take this kid. I don't know, he was eating steroids at 9 or something, but he was big. And the kid could just hurt you, you know? And well, we had problems. But anyway, when my dad was around and we'd walk and I'd see the kid, I'd call him all kinds of names, make faces at him. It was easy to do, but my pops were there and he was big, but not as big as my father. So that was okay, you know. But when my dad wasn't around, I'd move a little quicker and say a little less. David was good at keeping the Lord between him and the problems. That's a good lesson to learn. And yet, verse 4 says, God, or at the end of verse 3, God will send forth his mercy and his truth, but my soul is among the lions. I lie among the sons of men who are set on fire with teeth like spears and arrows and tongues like a sharp sword. Be exalted, God, above the heavens. Let your glory be above the earth. They've prepared a net for my steps. My soul is bowed down. They've dug a pit before me, and into the midst of it they themselves have fallen. You know, it's one thing to pray and wait upon the Lord, but sometimes you have to wait a while. And here you find David reviewing the difficult place he found himself in. If you go back and read Samuel, these 7.5 years were tough. You know, he got out of Gath. He was worried that Saul, if he couldn't find him, would go after his family. So he sent his family to Moab. He was warned by the prophet to get out of the Adullam caves because Saul was coming. He had a bunch of priests that got killed because he had showed up there to get some help. He had defended the city of Keilah, and then they turned around and routed him out. He went home to the Ziphites, who were part of his whole tribe. And the minute they heard Saul was looking for him, they go, he's over here. And they pointed David out. You know, he has Saul with 3,000 guys running through the hills of Israel in the southern portion of the Sinai, just determined to kill him. 3,000 guys looking for you. How would you like that? 3,000 guys looking for you. And if they catch you, you're dead. And David didn't want to be caught. And now he's in a cave, if this is that time, and in comes Saul, and now he's in the cave, all these hundreds of guys, and nobody can sneeze, or breathe hard, or snicker, or, you know, have an itch. You better be quiet. And Saul lays down to go to sleep. And David had been teaching his men about how God was going to protect all of them. And the minute Saul's asleep, they say to David, see, you were right, the Lord brought him to us, let's kill him. And David goes, I don't think this is the way the Lord works. Oh yeah, he works, he put him to sleep, look, right in front of us, he's dead. Come on, David. And David moves forward with his sword, but he just cuts off a corner of his robe and then realizes, man, he can't do this. If someone's dying, God's going to have to kill him. God put him in the job. God's got to take him out. He didn't feel like he was God's, you know, boss to fire this guy. The Lord will have to do it. And Saul eventually woke up and he crossed the ravine. And when he got to the other side, David yelled at him and said, hey, Saul. You're a wicked man for coming here trying to kill me. And I just want to show you, look, here's your robe. Check out your hair. Yeah, you got it cut, don't you? There goes that designer robe, you know? I could have killed you if I wanted. And to be honest with you, the vote was not in your favor. But I realized that's not the Lord. So you should know I'm not out to hurt you. And Saul, for 5 minutes, when I'm so sorry, I'm such a goof, you know? But the next day he was embarrassed and he came back harder than ever. And David had done it right. But in order to do it right, he had to do 7 more years of running. That's hard, isn't it? I'm going to do it the Lord's way, but in order to do that, I've got to go without a whole lot longer than if I had just taken it in my own hands. And so David talked about them preparing a pit and falling in it themselves because the Lord got him off the hook that time. And so he says in verse 7 as he goes off, my heart is steadfast, O God, my heart is steadfast. Notice the repetition is just meant to highlight the verse like an exclamation. I will sing, I will give praise, so awake my glory, lute and harp, and awaken the dawn. You know, very poetic, but what David is saying is I'm going to wake up early and sing and praise the Lord. I'm going to wake up the dawn and praise you, Lord, among the people and sing to you among the nations. Your mercy reaches to the heavens, your truth to the clouds. You be exalted, God, above the heavens, and let your glory be above all of the earth. And so he repeats that refrain again from verse 5. God, you got me off the hook. You delivered me. What a blessing. Saul was, by the way, still on the throne, but David was going to get up like the rooster and brag, you know, how good God was. David was going to run. Saul was going to chase him. But David found his victory long before Saul was dead. Psalm 58 is another engraving of David. And the topic, though it's not introduced, is one of just dishonesty and justice. And David's words about injustice on the bench, and particularly for those allowing Saul to carry out his vengeance, you know, rights of these things, but the perennial issue is always on the scene. You know, there's very unevenness in justice, isn't there? You know, depending on who you are and who you know and how much money you can afford a lawyer for, you know, your sin can go unpunished or greatly punished. But David was very frustrated at the wrongdoing of men that was kind of written off as okay, you know, just the way the world is, man. You know, wickedness, when wickedness rules, then you're not always going to get justice. It'll come eventually. And I think that's David's point. So he writes here in verse 1, do you indeed speak righteousness, you silent ones? Do you not judge uprightly, you sons of men? No. In heart you work wickedness. You weigh out the violence of your hands in the earth. The wicked are estranged from the womb, go astray as soon as they are born, speaking lies. Their poison is like that of a poison of a serpent. They are like the deaf cobra that will stop its ear, which will not heed the voice of the charmers, charming ever so skillfully. He calls these judges the sons of men in verse 1 because there's a higher judge, and describes them as wicked in heart. You know, Jesus will say years later, a good man out of the good treasures of his heart will bring forth good, but an evil man out of the evil treasure of his heart will bring forth evil. Out of the abundance of the mouth, of the heart, the mouth will speak. So here's cause and action. You know, David is saying your wickedness brings violence upon the earth, and the wickedness that drives you is something you are born with. Notice, estranged from your womb, you go astray as soon as you're born, speaking lies. Mark Twain was not a believer, but he wrote a little essay about sin that I thought was very interesting, and I wrote it down. I'll read it to you. This is his words. He said, I don't remember my first lie. It's far too far back. But I remember my second lie. I was 9 days old. And I noticed that if a pin was sticking to me and I advertised it in the usual fashion, I got loved and held and petted and even got a ration between meals. So I lied about the pin, advertising when there was no problem with it at all. But then you've done the same thing, haven't you? I've never met a child yet who was able to rise above the temptation and keep from telling a lie. Interesting, because that's how sin nature works. It'll get us to lie before we tell the truth. So David speaks about wandering from the moment you're born. Injustice is ingrained into the nature of man. So if we don't have the Lord to give justice, we're not going to have it. We're going to have sin, aren't we? And he says in verse 4 about the poison of a serpent like a deaf cobra. You know, all snakes are deaf. Snakes react by sight. They don't hear you coming. They feel you coming. And cobras are charmed not by music, but by the movement of the flute. If you've ever gone to some of these places where they have snake charmers like that, you know, most of the time these magician guys will defang the cobras first because they're not very predictable. And you don't want to be wrong, like even once. But David saw these judges as snakes without the ability to charm or control, just incurably evil, you know, responding to wickedness as sin. So very poetic, but yet you get the point. And in very rapid succession, David asks the Lord, or suggests to the Lord, what he wishes would happen to these deceiving judges. He said in verse 6 very clearly, break their teeth in their mouths and break out the fangs of these young lions, Lord. Let them flow as water continually. And when he bends his bow, let his arrows be as if cut in pieces. Let them be like a snail which melts away as it goes, or a stillborn child of a woman that may not see the sun. And before your pots can feel the burning thorns, he shall take them away with a whirlwind, as is his living and burning wrath. So David prays they be defanged and dry up like a stream and be destroyed like a weapon and dissolved like a snail in the slime as he goes. A very poetic, picturesque, but you know, if you're writing songs, you don't want to just write. You want to be creative. Ending with, you know, the guy who gets thorns to start a fire and the whirlwind comes and the fire runs in all directions. He says, it's kind of like God's wrath. You know, when it comes, it's going to catch you. But his wish is that God would straighten out the wickedness. He adds in verse 10, the righteous shall see when God takes vengeance. When he shall wash his feet in the blood of the wicked, men will say, surely there is a reward for the righteous, and surely he is God who judges in the earth. I think that we often, you know, pray the same thing in many ways, you know. The old poet said, truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. But that doesn't last forever. I mean, eventually God's going to come and make it right. And we like that, don't we? We like when the world kind of sees the Lord for who he is, when the vindication comes. But I think you'd probably, you know, suffocate if you were holding your breath to see that take place. God's very merciful, very patient. On the day when the Lord comes to judge, everyone will know who's who. But so often we don't get that immediate justification we hope for. And so when you just, God just make it right. Well, he'll make it right, but just not in your time. But David is very frustrating, calls for God to break their teeth in their mouth. That's a great memory verse, isn't it? Oh, Lord, just break their teeth in their mouth. Now, if you feel that way, you might as well pray that way. God knows what you're thinking anyway. Chapter 59, a michtam. You liking that word? Michtam. Of David, when Saul sent men and they watched the house in order to kill him. Saul had his dogs who were often turned loose to chase David. You could call Psalm 59, beware of the dogs. But here's an introduction, and it is early on in David's history of running. In fact, this was right at the beginning of David basically quitting his job of playing, you know, gigs in front of Saul. He was throwing his sword at him now and his spear and all. And David had begun to run, and he was off to a running start, if you will. This is one of the earliest of the Psalms that he wrote. And you might remember the story how that David had gone home to his wife, who happened to be Saul's daughter, and there were a bunch of folks gathered around the house waiting to take him in the morning. And David had this tremendous dilemma, you know, that he didn't know what to do. He finally got the idea. If he made a dummy in bed, had his wife tell the soldiers in the morning he was sick in bed, so if they looked in, they might see a shape there. Told his wife to just tell her dad he threatened to kill her, you know, so that you'd be safe. And he goes out a window and he's off to the races. But this was young David, who hadn't really done anything wrong but served the Lord and been blessed by it, finding now, you know, the wickedness of the world, the dogs, if you will, at his door. So he writes, as most of these psalms tonight, crying out for help, deliver me from my enemies, O my God, and defend me from those who would rise up against me, and deliver me from the workers of iniquity, and save me from these bloodthirsty men. So David faced lots of assaults in his life. Most of them were straightforward like this, but here these guys were hiding. Deliver me, defend me, save me. And then he says, for look, they lie in wait for my life. The mighty gather against me, not for my transgression nor for my sin, Lord, but they run and prepare themselves through no fault of mine. And I think that that's always maybe the worst kind of trial, isn't it? I think if you can say, well, I'm in Gath and I shouldn't be here, at least you can justify your suffering. But when you do the right thing, you've been getting up early and reading your Bible, you've been seeking the Lord, and you go to your work and get fired. Hey, Lord, maybe you haven't noticed I've been really praying and stuff. No fault of my own. What are you doing? That's frustrating, you know? Or you're taking money out of your bank account and helping someone who's broke, and then they turn on you. Hey, Lord, got a little beef to pick with you. David writes the same thing here. They're chasing me for no good reason. And that's hard. Because here's a young prince on his knees crying to God as the bloodthirsty hounds wait outside till dawn. And David is free to go to the Lord for help. But he is innocent of the lies of Saul. And he hasn't tried to become a king or take his job. He's just been faithful. So David cries, "Awake, Lord." Not that the Lord was asleep, but it feels that way sometimes. "Awake to help me and behold," or look closely. "You therefore, Lord, God of hosts, God of Israel, awake to punish the nations and don't be merciful to any of these wicked transgressors." Which seems to be more prophetic than most of what we have read so far, because there's now the cry for God to deliver the nation from wicked transgressors. Then he says in verse 6, "At evening they return growling like a dog. They go around the city, they belch with their mouth. Swords are in their lips. They say, 'Who's hears? Who hears us?' But you, Lord, shall laugh at them, have all of the nations in derision. I'll wait for you, O you, his strength. God is my defense." Pretty cool. Outside, they're saying, "Who hears?" Inside, David is saying, "Lord, I know you hear. So do not slay them, lest my people forget. Scatter them by your power. Bring them down, O Lord, our shield. For the sin of their mouth and the words of their lips, let them be taken in their pride. For the cursing and the lying which they speak, consume them in their wrath. Consume them that they may not be, and let them know that God rules in Jacob to the ends of the earth." What a great prayer. And then he repeats again, "At the evening they return growling like a dog, going around the city, wandering up and down for food, howling if they're not satisfied. But I'm going to sing of your power. I'm going to sing aloud of your mercy in the morning. You've been my defense and refuge in the day of my trouble. To you, O my strength, I will sing praises, for God is my defense. He's my God of mercy." You get the idea as you go through these Psalms that everything comes down to, what do you know about God and what are you willing to trust him with, don't you? Because it isn't so easy. You know, if you ever listen to guys giving testimonies or something on television or hear what the Lord has done, you get the impression that, you know, the only thing that different between us and them is they've gotten the victory and we haven't. You know, how did they get that deliverance? Why isn't God doing that for me? I suspect that most of that is just a matter of time. We wait upon God because God will do what God says. It doesn't happen overnight. It's worth putting, you know, your shoulder to the grindstone and just saying, "God, I'm going to stay put." You know, they're barking in the streets. They're wandering around for food. They're wicked transgressors. They're running for my life. They're lying about me. I haven't done anything wrong. But God, I'm just going to trust you. What a great end to yourself. You know, each trial brings with it the realization that you can't really do much other than trust the Lord. It might sound like a broken record, but it seems to me it's a broken record we need to listen to. Because more often than not, we only trust the Lord till there's trouble. And then we go, "I don't know. I've been praying. I've been seeking. I've been, but I don't know where God has been." Finally, tonight in Psalm 60, we have a fairly long introduction. And it says, "For a michtam of David for teaching when he fought against Mesopotamia and Syria of Zobah, and Joab returned and killed 12,000 Edomites in the valley of Salt." Now, if you go back through 2 Samuel 8 or 1 Chronicles 18 or 1 Kings chapter 11, there are all of these different battles between David and those groups of folks that are mentioned there in separate places. What we do know from all of them is that by the time that you read Psalm 60, David is no longer just running for his life. David is now the king over all of Israel. And David has taken it upon himself to do what the people in Joshua's day had failed to do. He was going to go take the land God gave them. And so many of these battles that you read about there are taking up arms to go and get the land that God had promised, fights that had been forsaken during the times of Judges. Certainly Saul didn't do anything. You know, his whole job was to kill David. So these references to these battle places and these enemies were just that, David going to get that which God had promised. And so we read in verse 1, O God, you have cast us off and broken us down and been displeased. Now, restore us again. You've made the earth to tremble. You've broken it. Heal the breaches. It's shaking. You've shown your people hard things. You've made us drink the wine of confusion. When David was in the north fighting Syria for quite some time, and those in the northern area of Lebanon expanding Israel's borders and taking the land that God had promised, there was one victory after another. I mean, they were on a roll. You know, you'd want to be in David's army. They were doing well. But in the north, and as they were fighting, according to those chapters back in the historical books, the Edomites, who were down in the south, invaded in the Sinai up through the southern part of Jordan, and they sought to cut the land in half. So that had they been, you know, successful, it literally would have been, you know, David losing half of the land because most of his army was in the north and the people were pretty much frightened and alone in the south. David hears about it, and in his dismay, he asks the Lord here in this psalm why God had forsaken them to this. He will realize, as he writes, that though the Lord had been giving them victory, the people had begun to presume that they would win anyway. And the faith that was driving them in their early battles had kind of given way to confidence in self. And so the Lord's purposes in all of this, though you won't read it necessarily in the historical books, was to take an army that had begun to rely upon themselves and set the record straight. They better rely upon the Lord. And David was listening, and David was learning the right lesson. It wasn't a sweet lesson, but it was a quickly learned one. And so notice that David says to the Lord here in chapter 60, you've broken us down, cast us off. We need to be restored. The earth is trembling. You know, we've been made to be confused. And so he continues on, and it's a lesson, I think, that we need to learn too, that when things go well for us, we've got to be careful, I think, to not lay back and presume upon God or just lean on our own resources or our own ways and, you know, think we've gotten this far, we can handle it now, you know. There's something to be said for constant dependency upon God. Not an easy lesson to learn, because when, you know, you're rolling downhill, usually the only thing you're worried about is steering. What you should be doing is asking the Lord where to go. And so David finds that here. And he says in verse 4, you have given a banner to those who fear you that it may be displayed because of the truth, that your beloved may be delivered, save with your right hand, and hear me. So in the confusion over the attack in the south, and yet realizing some of the reasons why, David turns to the Lord, and he asks that they learn again to march under God's banner. We may have given the enemy an advantage. How? We have been trusting in ourselves. So David says, hear our prayers, help us to march under your name again. And then according to the historical book, David sent Joab south. And he sent him with a huge bunch of guys. But they went not counting up their army reserves. They went saying, the Lord go before us. And though they were, you know, a large force, they went in faith. They went back to what got them this far. Let's go back to doing things God's way. You've made us confused, but you've given us a banner. If we'll just fear you, then we have a banner to walk under. Your truth can be our banner. Your word can be our banner. You can deliver your beloved and save with the right hand. But it's got to be those who fear you, and they hadn't been. So he says in verse 6, God has spoken in his holiness, and I will rejoice and divide Shechem and measure out the valley of Succoth. Gilead is mine. Manasseh is mine. Ephraim also is the helmet for my head. Judah, a lawgiver, Moab is a washpot. And over Edom, I will cast my shoe, and Philistia shout in triumph because of me. And so David goes on and he reasserts the fact that this nation and land belong to God and his people. And he claims it, if you will, in prayer, that if they will walk with God, that's exactly how these things will turn out. The Lord will take those places that he has committed, whereas Moab and Edom will find themselves discarded. You know, there'll be a place for the enemy to take off his shoe or have their shoes taken off. There'll be a place of defeat. because of me, you can shout in triumph as you triumph over Edom, over Moab, over the Philistines. But it's going to have to be my way. When the people of God are his, then the enemies of God are done. Great verse. They've been acting way too presumptuously. And David even prays that God will bring his forces down all the way into that area of Edom. So he says in verse 9, who will bring me to the strong city, possibly Petra? Who will lead me into Edom? Is it not you, God, who have cast us off? And you, God, who did not go out with our armies? Now give us help from trouble, for the help of man is useless. And through God we can do valiantly, for it is he who shall tread down our enemy. That's a great lesson to learn, isn't it? You're the one who's quit helping us. And if we get to your help again, we'll do fine. But you want to be careful when you begin to act too presumptuously and, you know, not stick to where you got us there. I think that there's great truth in, you know, staying in many ways where you started. You know, I remember getting saved on a Thursday night in September in Bellflower at a home Bible study. And I got saved, and I went to church 4 or 5 nights a week, and we drove out to Costa Mesa and sat in the tent with Chuck, and he used to take us through the Bible on Sunday nights. And he'd start at 7:30, and he'd quit at 10 sometimes. And we were always mad that he quit so early because, oh, just 2 more chapters, 5 more hours. Come on, you can do it. And Chuck used to talk fast. He don't talk so fast always now, but for 80, I think he's doing pretty good, you know? But he used to really just go at it. You do 10 chapters, and oh, I just loved it. And then I got to where I just thought, well, I don't need to go 3 or 4 nights a week. I can go once a week because I know stuff. And I found a lot of things began to be missed in my life, you know, the joy of the Lord and confidence when I prayed and just being reminded of what God wanted to do. And so I had to go back to just opening the Bible. You know, there's something about reaping what you sow. And it is so easy once you begin to grow. And maybe I'm singing to the choir because you're here on Sunday night. And I'm very proud of you for doing it. I think you couldn't make a better choice. But there's a lot of folks who don't make those choices. And it hurts them, I know. And it all comes down to, you know, stay with what got you here. Because the land is still filled with the enemy, and God will go with you and give you victory, but you're going to have to depend upon him, you know. Through God we can do valiantly. He'll tread down the enemies, but without God, we're done. And it's a lesson David needed to learn more than once as he took over the land that God gave him. Next week, Lord be willing, we'll take 61, 2, 3, 4, and 5. So you'll have to study ahead and make some notes for yourself and see what the Lord would tell you next week. Father, thank you tonight for your word to us. And as we plug along through these Psalms and seek to just learn your heart, I pray that you would make alive to us these things as we read them, and that your word would just fill our hearts. We think tonight especially about David, Lord, in all of these different situations in his life, and then writing songs to relate to us the truths of God. That fear meets faith there in Psalm 56, and how the Lord was called upon to just hide David there in Psalm 57 as he's running through the En-Gedi caves. And Lord, how much we need to learn these lessons. May they get into our hearts, from our head to our hearts. May they travel those 18 inches where they can do some good. As David saw the dishonesty around him, he realized that, Lord, you're the one that's going to make things right. As he wrote about the dogs that surrounded his own house, or the wars that he fought, where he began to learn that he had to depend upon the Lord. It just seems, Lord, every psalm brings us back to faith placed in action against the backdrop of the circumstance, and that we might apply what we learn and walk in what we know and do what you say. And so we pray tonight that your word would fill our hearts, that you would teach us your ways, that you would help us hear from you. And that, Lord, as we go our way tonight, whether it's to the afterglow in a few minutes in the mini chapel or to fellowship hall to have some dessert or for the kids that are, the college kids that are meeting tonight at 8, may you just speak, move, bless, and keep us close to you so that we would not just hear your voice, we would do it. and it would find then in us, Lord, the peace that you want us to have. If tonight you need prayer, the prayer room is out front here. I don't know if it's open. Whether it's about your relationship with the Lord or just applying what God has said to you tonight into your life. There will be folks there who'd love to just pray with you, talk with you, and encourage you personally. So make use of it. And may the Lord keep you close to him this week.
Well, thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing and rating our podcast. You can visit us on the web at morningstarcc.org and on our YouTube channel at morningstarcc. Again, that's at morningstarcc. If you'd like to support this podcast, please look us up at patreon.com/morningstarcc. Again, that's Patreon, patreon.com/morningstarcc.